Now, the shotgun start in golf is full of mathematics. There's a lot of setup work that we have to do in order to make a tournament work. So I'm going to demonstrate to you just exactly how we do a shotgun start here.
And here we go.
All right, all right, all right. Gentlemen, start your
greetings and welcome to a Friday edition of the Shotgun Start. It is May 8th. Andy, how are we doing?
Brendan, I'm doing good. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Birthday podcast. That's all we are now. Birthday podcast.
It's a big day when it's one of the hosts' birthday for a birthday pod.
Internet's already brutal. This is the perils of a mid-morning part. Podcast, you know, we got Zoom meetings, school meetings going on all over this house right now, so the Wi-Fi may be spotty, but we are delayed. We had a little schedule conflict Thursday night. Figured it'd be, you know, it's not the most time sensitive. We're doing a hopefully a good Ben Crenshaw spotlight today, so we figured we'd bump it. We'll be at our freshest Bixby loaded up best this morning and release it by lunch on Friday.
Yeah, I just got a fresh shipment of Bixby. My subscription came.
I think I've timed up the subscription perfectly. Like, mine came literally the day I poured the last beans of the prior one into the grinder. And I was getting anxious. I didn't know, you know, I thought there might be a gap. But I think I'm timed up as we fiend our way through quarantine on coffee.
See, that's kind of like what I think is one of the greatest golf achievements. My What's favorite that? Thing is when I end the round, like with one tee on the last hole.
In your pocket?
Or yeah.
What do you mean? Okay. That's a good... I never thought that way.
I love it because then I come home... Because I always have tees in my pockets. Yeah. It drives my wife crazy.
They're right? Everywhere.
She's like, why are all these tees everywhere? And I mean, they're just piles all over the house. So my favorite is when I end with like one. Like the one problem I run into is if it breaks on the last hole, I don't have something to fix the ball mark.
Okay.
But it is my favorite thing when I have
no
tees.
You don't carry a divot repair tool or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
T's the best tool.
I gotcha.
Divot repair tools a lot of times promote bad technique.
Bad repair. Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, that's dicey then. Then you look like a putz if you're up on the green and you're empty pocket and you got nothing. I mean, it's a fine line you got to walk there,
that's,
I guess.
That's when I get my keys out. I use a car key then.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Then I'm ready to go.
Do you have your keys in your pockets when you play?
Well, I'll just grab it out of the bag. It's just
At that point, can't you get a tee out of the bag?
Well, I'm going to need the keys before I need the next tee.
Okay, gotcha. All right, you've thought of this through, I can tell. Huh. All right.
I take pride in grabbing the right amount of tees for the round of golf.
Interesting. So your mind is a funny place. I like it. But you've got all the details considered. All right, so we will bump kind of news discussion to Monday, more of a regular episode on Monday, so this doesn't go 18 hours on Crenshaw. What news do we have? Just everyone getting hollering about VJ. I got a text earlier in the week that was coming, that he had signed up for some web events or KFT events, whatever they call it now, and that there would be outcry. But I don't know that I expected guys, you know, calling him a piece of garbage or trash or whatever Brady Schnell called him. So we'll talk. Well, go ahead.
It's very conflicting. I can find myself on either side of the coin with it.
We'll talk about it Monday. But I think it's bad on multiple fronts from both sides. Yeah. VJ should be doing it. Let's not call him a piece of garbage. Let's, you know. We'll talk about that on Monday. The match is official. The Champions for Charity. We got Peyton, Tom, Phil and Tiger at Medalist on May 24th, which I believe is the Sunday after the first one at Seminole.
The stage trash talk has begun.
Yeah, seriously. They definitely, we'll talk about it on Monday. They definitely split up those teams to give guys, like, Peyton's going to drag Tiger along in terms of banter, and Phil will drag, you know, the automaton, that robot that is Tom Brady along, right? So we'll talk about that.
The NFL schedules are out.
Schedules?
I saw
they can't. They were pronouncing it wrong all night. Trey Wingo's coming on. He's calling it hard K. Schedule. It's schedule, Trey. Any reaction to that?
I like our early season schedule. It could give us some hope as a Bears fan. We could get off to a hot start. We aren't playing that first place schedule on it like we did last year. It's one of
were
the
you guys the opener last year, Packers? Is that,
yeah.
Is that right?
Okay. It was just a thrilling game, you know, where like high 10-3. Scoring affair. Yeah. Mitch was just abysmal. God, he stunk in that game. It's just think about the Bears defense, where you're like holding one of the greatest quarterbacks in the league to like just stifling them, and you've got a guy that and just giving short fields, and you got a guy that just cannot do anything.
Yeah,
it's gotta be disheartening.
I think I saw someone tweeted us that the Bears and Browns play the first preseason game of the year.
Wow.
Should we do go to that? Just some garbage. It probably won't happen. Probably won't have fans or whatever. You know, we're talking mid-August. Maybe it has fans.
Do you think we could
optimistic.
Get press credentials?
Just like the fourth stringer playing for 89, 20, 90% of it, you know? That would be kind of a fun podcast. Make some KFT parallels or something like that. Anything else on the schedule? It looks like they're clearing the decks for Master Sunday. There are no CBS games at 1 o'clock on what would be Master Sunday, November 15th. I got a few messages about U.S. Open Sunday, the 20th, maybe, I think it is. That Fox, the early round stuff will be on FS1, and then kind of the last conclusion looks like could be on Fox with only one late game on Fox, late NFL game on Fox, which could be cool. I don't know what that means, last six holes. Nine holes, something on at Wingfoot on Fox could be the case. But we're just reading the tea leaves based on the NFL schedule.
We're now, you know, 5 minutes into news. We said we weren't doing it. I was going to say next Sunday is going to be cool with that Seminole match leading into the Last Dance. It's going to feel like a pretty normal day.
Yeah, that's not a bad observation. Maybe. It's Sunday.
Like somewhat of a sports day. You know?
Sunday with some diversion, some you know content to consume
and variety, and two things like we have not been given more than one thing.
I mean, right now we have you know NBA, NHL playoffs, golf in full swing. Yeah, stinks. All right,
we'd be at Trinity Forest. Somebody tweeted at me yesterday was like it hadn't rained in a while in Dallas. It was 78 degrees with 22-mile-an-hour winds, and it would have just been...
That's a shame.
Just bad luck all around for Trinity Forest.
Yeah. Okay, should we do 10 more minutes on tacos? Any desire to
do
that?
No, I'm good.
We got a lot of feedback on that the other day. All right, let's get into Ben. Do you want to do Bixby? BixbyCoffee.com/shotgunstart. I don't know if it's slash, but subscribe to our blend. It's never a better time to just be fueling up on coffee. You know, golf is back. Playing golf, I should say. So, I don't know. I'd say coffee golf in a way is back. So Shotgun Start Blend at Bixby Coffee. Proceeds, portion of it supports the podcast. They have been great partners from day one. Anything else to add on that? We've done. You can cancel anytime. We may do a giveaway at some point. We'll see. You can cancel anytime. It roasts that day and it's at your doorstep. Usually about 3 days, maybe sometimes faster for me. But yeah, it's on your doorstep like 2 to 3 days later.
Freshest coffee you can get.
Yeah. And you still got to do your cold brew. You've been teasing this. This is like the Jazzy J deep dive. You're cold doing an Instagram story on your cold brew method. You just keep kicking it down the road.
It's been too cold here.
You're kicking the carafe down the road.
All right. I'll try. Maybe try and do it this week.
Okay. too cold. The external temperatures outside have to be appropriate for you to be doing your cold brew tutorial?
Yeah, I don't like waking up and drinking something really cold when my house is really cold in the morning. I have to go outside with the dog.
Just do the tutorial for the people. The people live in a lot of different locales. They don't all live in Chicago.
Well, it's got to be convenient for me. I'm not.
What's the threshold for cold brew? What is it, like 67 and a half degrees outside?
Yeah, I like
What's
to have the... like a good stretch. It's got to have I make enough for 4 days. It's got to be a good stretch of weather for the cold brew.
Okay. All right. There you go. Let's dive into Ben Crenshaw. So he won the vote over Bernhard Lahner. Are getting mad at my pronunciation.
Lahner. Say you don't pronounce the G.
Tom Kite. And who was the fourth one?
Nick Whatever. Price.
Okay. Nick
it
Price.
It was a really close one. They were all in the 20 percentiles.
Oh, interesting. An even ballot. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
So Crenshaw wins. I would just say Crenshaw's, which was a revelation to me doing this, Crenshaw... I don't know if it's because he was the 99 Ryder Cup. He won the 95 Masters. Like, that's a part of our lives. I thought he was younger than he is. I'd say Crenshaw's on the very outer edges of, like, the generation we wanted to spotlight. The earliest edges. I didn't realize he was so early in the, you know, such a competitor in the 70s. And maybe that's a naive millennial speaking. I understand that. But I thought he was just the 95 Masters, 99 Ryder Cup made him feel more of the later generation, mostly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think also because he was so prolific at it in his youth, it wasn't one of those things where he was kind of a different tour pro, and I guess we'll get into this more when we do.
Yeah.
But he's a different where he was immediate sensation. So if he had been 30 doing that, he would have been late 70s into the 80s.
Yeah.
Which would have aligned well with like Curtis Strange and all that. But because he was so prolific at a young age, he kind of burst onto the scene.
Yep. So just that caveat at the front end. I'd say this is the very leading earliest edge of players for the generation we're focusing on mostly. Probably a little Seve coming later. But all right, let's get into it.
Seve and him match up really well.
Yep.
All right. Ben Crenshaw. Little Ben. Gentle Ben. Those are his kind of nicknames. So this
Little
is,
Ben's the putter, right?
Yeah, Little Ben's the putter, but they still call him Little Ben too.
Okay.
Jaime Diaz from Sports Illustrated article after he won in 96. If ever anyone should have had 95, my bad. If ever anyone should have had an easy road in golf, it was Ben Crenshaw. He was born with a transcendent talent, guided from boyhood by a master teacher. Blessed with a warm, humble manner, a handsome face, and a sharp mind. And he wielded, with perhaps the smoothest putting stroke ever, his own version of a wonder boy, Little Ben. The game simply had to be good to Ben Crenshaw. But competitive golf was never easy, and with Crenshaw's talent came massive expectations. When he finally encountered failure, the shock led him to question the gifts his teacher Harvey Pennock had implored him to trust. Somehow, too quickly, Crenshaw's road turned rough. When he won, it was because he was supposed to. When he lost, he disappointed destiny. Crenshaw found out how heartless the game can be.
That's a great... It would appear to be like a Diaz column the week after he won the 95 Masters. And after reading on Crenshaw for like 7-8 hours, it was... You know, that's towards the end of our research. It's like a really good encapsulation. Good way to lead off.
Yeah, so absolute sensation. I'm going to run down some facts here. Grew up in Austin, was just an unbelievable junior golfer.
Yeah.
And I think you've got more on details of that. Unbelievable collegiate golfer, played at UT, won 3 individual national championships the 3 years he did it. 3 years he played, he turned pro early. He also won the Trans Mist, the Porter Cup, the Western Am, the Sunny Ana, the Northeast. He won the Southern Am twice, the Eastern Am twice. He was a 3-time Haskins Award winner, which goes That's to the crazy. Best college golfer of, in a year. He turned pro in 73. He wins.
Could that happen today?
No.
You probably turn pro, right? Yeah. If you win it twice, you know?
Yeah. And think about, like, you know, like Matthew Wolff had an unbelievable year. I think Hovland won that year.
Yeah, I think, I mean, could you even do it even if you wanted to? But even if you could, I'm not sure you're around three years to do it. I don't even know if you could, though, to even, there's just so deep, so competitive.
I feel like Maverick McNealy had a chance, but he didn't back up. Like, he had a great sophomore year.
Yeah.
And he just didn't, but.
You got to do it as a freshman. Yeah. You have to do it as a freshman. Okay.
He qualified for the U.S. Open at 18.
Before he was at Austin, he went to UT.
Low amateur, which was for a long time the youngest low amateur.
Do you have who broke that? I don't. I didn't.
I didn't. Because
we're reading old articles at this point, right? So it's like a record at that point. But okay, go ahead.
Turned pro in 73. He wins Q School by 12 shots immediately after turning pro.
12 shots. Q School. 12 clear of everybody. Where was that? In Boca? Somewhere in Florida, right? The Q School? I forget. Or Myrtle Beach. Myrtle Beach. Hard courses in Myrtle Beach. He won by 12. Some tough setup. Go ahead.
He won his first start on the PGA Tour. He's one of five players to ever do that. Marty Fleckman, Jim Benep, Robert Gomez, Garrett Willis, and Russell Henley are the other ones.
I think he was only the second to do it at the time.
He was the second to do it at the time. What an illustrious list he joined there.
Yeah, that's true.
He finished second his next start at the. Did you get anything about that tournament?
I got a lot on that
crazy tournament.
Open,
we'll go into that. That's a crazy tournament. I kind of wanted to come back.
2 weeks in Pinehurst, kind of crazy. All right, let's go.
He won in three decades. And in total, he won two majors, two masters. Obviously, he had 17 other PGA Tour wins outside of the majors, one and one Euro Tour win, the Irish Open.
Irish Open.
He was the 99 Ryder Cup captain, four Ryder Cups as a player. So he did a lot of his damage before the world golf rankings existed, but there was the McCormick golf rankings.
I saw that.
Which he was in.
Which. McCormick also is responsible for the eventual world rankings too. Mark McCormick, you know. Okay, go ahead.
So he was in the top 10 of this from 76 through 81, and then he spent 80 weeks in the top 10 of the OWGR from 87 to 89. So he was a top 10 player for large, you know, probably 7 to 10 years. Let's see, 87, he finished in the top 10 of every single major. He finished in T4th in the first three and then finished T7th at the PGA that year. One of, you know, about 15 players that have ever done that.
Ricky,
one of them. He has the worst playoff record in the history of the PGA Tour, 0-8.
Yeah.
Here's this, you ready for his peak 10-year run?
Yeah, I'm fascinated if you were able to squeeze this in. There's multiple. I mean, who knows when it is? Go ahead, give it to me.
So we'll do the majors first. I chose 75 to 84, which his best golf was really when he was in his 20s.
Yeah, could argue, as Mike Clayton talked about with Seve, Seve's brother, saying his best golf was when he was playing, you know, 15, 16. I mean, Crenshaw's best golf may have been 18 to 22.
Crenshaw says that himself.
Yeah. Yeah, we got a quote or two. Professional peak run is, you're going 74, did you say?
75 to 84.
Okay.
So he makes 37 starts in majors. He has one win, 17 top 10s, five runner-ups, two thirds, and eight missed cuts. So 16% of the time, he finished in the top two of majors during that 10 years. 22% of the time in the top three. 46% of the time in the top 10. You know, sans the, you know, 22% of the time MC. So a little higher MC than, say, like a Faldo figure. Similar top 10 percentage. Those runner-ups were kind of heartbreaks over and over again.
Yes.
And kind of add up to what if
like
thing.
close top tens, not just like runner ups that were on the 71st hole, right? You know, 70 late Sunday runner ups, not just T7 where he finished 8 shots behind. There were some of those too, but he had several close top tens. I would just, are you done with the peak?
Well, okay. I'll do the PGA Tour kind of peak too.
I would just, you know, the major peak you just described excluded the 1 year he finished top 10 at all four, like they did the Ricky thing. Like it's hard to boil it down. You know, there's a lot of major contention and major major relevancy over the course of his career. Maybe he has only 2 major wins, those 2 Masters, but like, it's hard to make it, cram it into 10 years at the majors. You just excluded what may be his most competitive top to bottom year at the majors.
Yeah. And I think that was that's tough, but he had so many runner ups early. If I went to extend it there, what happened was I lost like 4 runner up finishes.
So maybe we could say he had like a 15 year peak at the majors. Maybe. I don't know. It's hard to find a 10 year window.
And I mean, it's tough. I think he, because of Augusta, the thing he had was he always could play. It was one of those things where he played Augusta well. So he always had that kind of, he had that longevity in majors because of that. He was an Augusta style player. And I think his game did change dramatically. He had a bout with a disease. Which kind of derailed the middle of his career. He spent essentially 2 years where they didn't know what it was. And then, you know, he lost a little bit of his power from it.
Graves disease, lost a lot of weight, didn't know why he was losing weight. He's like, I can't eat enough.
Yeah, New York Mets shortstop Jose Reyes had to deal with Graves disease.
Okay.
Because I found a New York Post article with Ben Crenshaw, and it was about Jose Reyes's, you know, and they called Crenshaw to talk about, you know, what he went through. So 10-year PGA Tour peak run, same years, 76, he finished second on the money list. He won, that was his 1 Euro Tour win year two. So he would have won 4 times that year.
So he won the Irish Open. I think I saw he had runner-up at Australian Open. Like mm-hmm. he was a world player. I mean, primarily a PGA Tour player, but he went outside the borders of the U.S.
Right. Yeah, so he had 247 PGA Tour starts during that period. He had 13 wins, 1 major, 8 other PGA Tour wins, 1 Euro Tour win, and 3 other wins, which include like the Texas Open and a Mexican Open. He might have been battling Club Pro guy down there.
I saw he had 3 Texas State Open wins.
Yeah.
After he turned pro. Was that common then? Like, he's a full-fledged PGA Tour pro. We're not talking about the Texas Open, you know, San Antonio. Like, going and playing, like, the Texas State Open or the Illinois Open, that's like a mix of, you know, AMs, club pros. I wonder if that was common.
I think it was more common then because the purses, I mean, he only won 25 grand when he won his first event. And I think the purse sizes weren't as big, so... You know, it's a tournament you could it probably was played in Austin. I didn't dig into it, but
I mean, imagine that if you're just some schlub. I mean, obviously a very good player in the Texas State Open. All of a sudden, you have Ben Crenshaw, maybe like the next Jack Nicklaus playing in that event against you. You know,
I think it was way more common then.
Yeah, I could see it, especially in Texas. You know,
and it was early in his career. It was before he was like superstar. You know, and I think the money was so much different going from the 70s to the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
So in total, he had 27 major top 10s in 21 years, which you would kind of bookend as his prime.
Yep.
Which is pretty impressive. Over 1 top 10 a year for 21 years is pretty damn good, especially considering, you know, 2-year kind of hiatus in there.
Very good.
Those are the details. You want to go into junior golf?
Nuts and bolts. I like it. I mean, there's Gentle Ben. There's a lot to talk about with him. We will try to keep it manageable. We know we'll miss some things, and you know, you can holler at us about it, what we missed in the comments or, you know, in DMs, as they say. All right.
Oh, one other note, fast fact.
Go ahead.
You know, one of the greatest golf architects of all time, too.
Yeah, I think like how we'll talk about it in legacy discussion, I guess, too. The architecture thing has to be a big part of what he's done for the game and who he is as a professional, especially when we're given the context of who we've spotlighted already, like Faldo design, Couples design, that like a lot of these guys are trying to do that. And Crenshaw, I would say, you know, design's a subjective awesome often, but like objectively is a giant in that business and much better than those guys, I would say. Okay. You've kind of hit a lot of the amateur stuff. I mean, he was low am at twice at the Masters, low am at the US. Like the guy was an 18-year-old playing competitive golf at the very highest level, not just, you know, around Austin. But we'll get into a little bit of the personality. Little Ben is the putter. It was a rear shafted relic that Crenshaw's dad, Charlie, gave to Ben for his 15th birthday. He kind of kept it for a very long time, off and on. His 15th birthday. It was a Wilson.
You know what happened? What? It got stolen.
Is that what it was? I didn't find that.
So he won. They talked about it. Just because it was the Western Open, I kind of dove into the Western Open a little bit. It got stolen a couple weeks before that, that he won in 92.
I think I vaguely remember that. So his 95 Masters win, they talk about how his buddy at Cleveland Classics made like a prototype of it. It like reminded it, like he tried to make one as close to it as he could, and that was part of the mystique of the 95 Masters win. So I was wondering what happened to the original.
Yeah, okay. It got stolen in Austin in 1992.
So it was a Wilson 8802 blade putter his dad bought him for his 15th birthday. Not a lot on the, like, his dad was an attorney in Austin. His mom, not a ton of like, his mom died on his third year as a pro, 1974, Pearl Crenshaw. She was a sixth grade school teacher, died of a heart attack. So a sudden death, definitely a tragedy early in Ben's pro career. His dad remarried to Roberta Bobby, who was a pretty wealthy philanthropist in the Austin area. Just a little bit on the personal. You did a lot of the, it was General Ben. I found this interesting. It was Dick Collins, an Austin American statesman, columnist or writer, who called him Gentle Ben. First person to call him Gentle Ben when he was in high school, because there was a TV series about a kid and a bear, and it was the bear that was called Gentle Ben. The name seemed appropriate at the time. Not the kid, the bear was Gentle Ben. And later on, even I think an Alan Shipnuck article this year, recently as this April, talks about how like there was a bit of like irony to the Gentle Ben, because he was a bit of a red ass on the course, right? Off the course, he was like just the most popular, gracious, warm person. But, you know, you watch some of these. I watched the 84 Masters. He's taken the Lord's name in vain a little time. There's some curses. There's some shout. Like, he gets angry.
I saw a snip, like a little thing in an article. It was actually about the losing the putter. And it was like, this is a, you know, he's never been without the putter. And he said something like, the only time I've been without Little Ben was when I was pulling it from trees.
That's right. There was another one in I did read that. And he lost, there was a Caddy Confidential or a Caddy article in SI, I think it was, of the caddy found the wrong ball, and they played the hole with the wrong ball. It was like all yellow. It had to be like, said it had been lost at Riviera for 5 years because it was yellowed over. They talk about, he gets dinged, they find out at the end of the hole, and Crenshaw yells, it like echoes through the eucalyptus, "You gotta be shitting me," like screams at the caddy. It's like, I deserve to be yelled at. Like, so a little bit of a Gentle Ben. He was, he could be a hothead on the course, extremely gracious, calm off the course, though. All right, so that's the origin of the nickname. Just a legend around Austin as a junior. He was like shooting in the low 70s as a teenager. In his senior year at Austin High, he won 18 of 19 tournaments that he entered.
Unbelievable. Here's a quote from Terry Jastrow. And this was in the Jenkins article.
This is about Penick?
Now, if you were young, if you were a young player in Texas and thought you were pretty good, all you had to do was watch Ben swing and see how much farther he hit it, and wonder to wonder about your own ability.
Here's another one from Sam Jastrow. Just putting it in context. There was something else that convinced you. A bunch of us would be on the practice range beating balls. With everybody else, Harvey Penick would spend an hour. But when he got around to Ben, he would look at him for a minute or two, smile, and tell him to just go play golf. That's definitely a theme we'll talk about throughout, is like just natural feel, go play. And then kind of a few times in his career where he got sideways was thinking too much about his swing. So he won 18 and 19 tournaments his senior year of high school at Austin High.
I think about 18 of 19.
I mean, so then that summer, before he's even at UT, he goes to Hazeltine, a terror of an open course. I think that was Jenkins.
One thing to note, everybody talks about how gracious Crenshaw was, how good of a sport Crenshaw was, how he'd be happy for other people after they won. And you see this throughout. When he needed two putts to qualify for the U.S. Junior
as a kid.
And what happened, he two putted, and then he called a penalty on himself because he said the ball moved when he addressed the putt. So, like, you know, as a kid at that age, it's pretty unbelievable that he called that penalty on himself.
Was that Brookline? Maybe the U.S. Junior? Maybe not. That might have been local.
I think it was a local qualifier.
Okay. So yeah, he called the penalty on himself on the last green. That was the difference. That was just part of the legend. And we'll get to how Bobby Jones was sort of his icon. A little bit of Jones in that story. So he goes to Hazeltine as an 18-year-old. He's the second youngest low amateur at the time in the history of the U.S. Open. And he beat Arnold Palmer, Nicholas, and Player in that U.S. Open at Hazeltine. So he goes to college.
Writers love Ben Crenshaw.
Oh, love Jenkins. Obviously, you know, Jenkins is from Texas, you know, and this is this Texas phenom since he's like 13 coming up. Everybody loves him. So like Diaz, like they loved writing about this guy. They loved him. And he probably was a great, great human being to them off the course too. So easy to write, you know, glowingly about.
So it's like a hard first round. He shot 75. He's like one of the leader, like 70 or 72 was leading. I can't remember. And he was called in the press tent, and they asked Ben. So the press guy goes, "Ben, would you go through your card, please?" The man says, meaning Crenshaw, to describe how he played each hole, the clubs he hit, the length of putts, and so on. "Sure," said Crenshaw, looking down at the copy of his scorecard. And then he read it into the mic. 4-4-5-2. The laughter interrupted him, and Crenshaw quickly caught on. He looked up from the scorecard and out at the crowd, embarrassed but smiling. I didn't mean to insinuate that none of you can read," he said. And this is Jenkins. "Crowds love a blonde, wee, embarrassed kid with a sense of humor." So that was like, that was the press's first, you know, meeting of Crenshaw at this U.S. Open, and they immediately fell in love because, like, he comes in, reads off his scorecard, then he's embarrassed and kind of jokes. He cracks a great joke. So that's from a Jenkins SI article.
I mean, that was a major thing, obviously, before you had TV and a ton of internet with all the shot tracker. That was a big thing. They still make them do that at the Masters, by the way. The green jacket who holds a press conference said, like, "Tiger, would you go through your card?" at the end of the press conference, and kind of blow by blow. It's kind of cool. All right. So, I mean, we don't need to go into his junior year too much. Just know he was a phenom. He's like shooting 71 as like a 15-year-old. This guy's going to be good. So he gets to college. Dave Williams, the head legendary coach at Houston, said, "Crenshaw is a superstar already, one of the top 10 players in the world, amateur or pro. I think he'll be better than Jack Nicklaus when he gets on tour." LeBron Harris, golf coach at Oklahoma State.
USAM winner.
His son. LeBron Jr., right?
He's a senior.
Yeah. Also,
Did
the dad win it too?
I don't know.
Also, grandfather of the greatest NBA player of all time, LeBron. No, I'm just kidding. The only other LeBron I've really ever encountered in my life, LeBron.
I think he's LeBron.
I know they pronounce it very differently. I just do that to be cheeky.
I've got some LeBron Harris clubs.
I've heard that. So he says he's another Jack Nicklaus or Bobby Jones in that class. Eddie Marin's the pro at Bel Air. Ben Swain is the type that will never stop repeating. It's like Sam Snead's. It was there the first time he swung a club, and it'll always be there. So we'll get into that a little bit. Some people thought the swing was too loose and long. But again, just natural swing. It's what he had from the start. So he gets to college. You know, just a little bit more background. He was like obsessed with the whole amateur game, right? He's obviously like a student of the classics, a great student of history. He talks about being sort of in a trance when he played as a junior at Brookline, Shinnecock. He's like, when I got on those old East courses, I was like always kind of everything flew out the window. I was just like in love and in a trance, played well. So this is just more background. Golf's an amateur game is what Crenshaw said. That's how it began and that's its backbone. I think we're getting in trouble these days. Well, let's do that on architecture. I think we're getting in trouble these days leaning more towards a professional game. I mean, so many courses are being built for professionals. It's not right. It's short-sighted. I guess when you get down to it, I'm a professional amateur. So just this is some context of his earliest days. And his enduring hero was Bobby Jones. And he goes, he's a man I love, but I've never met. Because Jones died in Atlanta when Ben was only 19. Go ahead.
To give some context about Crenshaw's game when he was young, Williams, the Texas coach, in an SI article,
Houston coach, said this.
It was about the NCAA championship. He said this place is made for a masher who can putt. That's Crenshaw. Uh-huh. So think, you know, just long off the tee, unbelievable putter.
Right. So we thought, like, I mean, people our generation think of him as like little Ben, like this kind of short and smaller guy. But he burst on the scene, won a freshman NCAA title with the guy saying it was built for a masher, and that's Ben, right? And obviously the disease in the middle of his career changed that style a little bit. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's get to Texas. We talked about how his love of the amateur. He won 3 NCAA of individual titles. You talked about that. One was a tie with Kite, which we'll go into in detail a little bit. And his last year he's Haskins Award winner all 3 times. His last year, he won 11 of 15 tournaments as a junior in college. This isn't a senior year at Austin High. 11 of 15 tournaments during the time when college golf was really strong era of college.
That's the thing, is this is a great era of college golf, like Lanny Watkins. There was a lot of great college golfers at this time.
Pierce, I think. Yeah. Eddie Pierce.
That's a great story, Eddie Pierce.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw Bill that Fields
might be,
just
it might
wrote
be
a
flashlight. Future I know. Flashlight.
I know. All right, so let's do freshman year NCAA. 1971, you talked about Tucson National. It's made for a masher. That's Crenshaw. I got to go off topic here for a little bit. NCAA just sounded like a complete circus act here in the 70s. Did you read some of these details? Yeah. Hey, I love that SI would send a writer to cover it every year.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. And like they're like, this is an awesome, maybe the best amateur tournament out there. It's so fun. But NCAA officials were enjoying the 71 NCAAs, Tucson Nationals, were enjoying their usual hoo-ha of internal politics, public relations difficulties, and organizational buffoonery. They went bogey, double bogey, pick it up. This is Curry Kirkpatrick in SI. The NCAA, here, they couldn't find enough caddies. They couldn't open the practice greens or tees after 5 p.m., 5 o'clock. Play is like, come on, there's tons of guys there. You can't putt after 5? The NCAA turned simple rulings on the course into lengthy discourses. Play was so slow that Florida's Killian, who went off last, finished his round in a cool 7.5 hours.
Holy.
Hooray, hooray, another NCAA fiasco, he said. And while Watkins, Lanny, always apt at gentle criticism, commented, this would be a great tournament if it wasn't run by a bunch of jerks. College kids saying that about the NCAA.
Some things never change.
Yeah. Last night before the finals, Crenshaw was Texas was 15 shots behind. Crenshaw was resigned to the team defeat because I guess we're out of it. But on the individual, Mills can't hold up. Pierce is tough, but I want to make All-America. I want to be the first freshman to win this thing. I'm going to set a record. It is said around Austin. This is crazy. I tweeted this today. Said around Austin that Texas left the Southwestern Conference Golf League just so General Ben could play in more medal tournaments than the league allows. I might not have gone to Texas if they had stayed in, he admitted. And he had already become something of a local legend with a bunch of 61s, impressive appearances in the U.S. Open. Two impressive appearances in the U.S. Open. So that was a cool anecdote from the Kirkpatrick article. That they maybe left the Southwestern Conference. I don't know if it's hyperbole, but more of that so that Ben could play more medal events than the conference allowed. There's also a fun anecdote about Charlie's dad saying, you need to go to Texas so you can stay close, UT, so you're close to Harvey. You know, hey, get out of whack. You want to be home and go see Harvey if anything happens. So we go to the final day. They're Texas behind 15. Crenshaw wants to go for individual stuff. Crenshaw's teammate Kite, all but forgotten, Tom Kite is with them, started the Longhorn Stampede when he began with four birdies and eagle. So Kite starts to charge. The team is coming back. Crenshaw, mashing it for all he was worth, caught and passed Mills and turned the tournament around single-handedly. It was Crenshaw against the whole NCAA now, and it seemed that all you could hear were shouts of hook 'em horns. This is in Tucson. I give him a 66. This is at the turn. I give him a 66, said Florida coach Bishop, as Crenshaw turned the front nine in 3-under. Then a Houston player was like, if we shoot par, we can still beat him. Houston's coach Williams just stared at the ground. I know him too well. This kid could go for 62. It's all over.
Unreal.
He's a freshman at Texas. And it was. The Longhorns, 8-under, became the first team NCAA history to break par for the four rounds. But of course, it wasn't the Longhorns who did it. It was General Ben alone. His 273, he ended up with a 65 on the last day. It was 15-under. As he came up the last fairway, the 19-year-old Crenshaw asked, what am I even doing here? The question required no answer. He was right where he belonged, just on a complete heater as a freshman. I think he was the first ever freshman to win the NCAA title.
I mean, it's such a different time, too. Like, freshmen, I don't know if freshmen were even allowed to play basketball at this point as a freshman.
No, I don't think so. I mean, early 70s?
You think about Kareem at UCLA.
Think about the prospect of, and maybe it's hyperbole, of a leaving a conference potentially just because some local legend could play. I don't know if that's true.
I don't think that's true.
Fun to consider though. I like the story that's told around Austin. All right. So 72, he wins again. This is where we can, I don't know if we want to save this for our Kite one, but this is really a Crenshaw versus Kite. And then we can go into the dynamic of those two, both being mentored by Harvey.
Both from Austin,
both playing at UT at the same time. For the past, this is Barry McDermott. Crenshaw wins again, or ties individual.
Polar opposite personalities.
Totally. And they didn't get along. They were not friends. It's presumed that they were like best boys and just rampaged through college golf, but because they were both Harvey proteges, but they were very polar opposites, didn't get along great. Kite was often very, very frustrated by Crenshaw. Crenshaw just kind of sailed through life, didn't matter. I don't know if Kite bothered him that much.
They got along later in life.
Later in life, absolutely. For the past 3 years, Barry McDermott, this is the writing, the past 3 years, people have been predicting that Crenshaw, now only 20, would be the next Jack Nicklaus or the new Arnold Palmer or the future Bobby Jones. He has a classic rhythmic swing, hits the ball with a crunch and chips and putts with dexterity. Ben and Tom are complete opposites, said their teammate Brent Buckman. Tom is perfectionist. He goes out on the practice tee, hit balls and balls all day. If he doesn't hit each one perfectly, he'll get mad at himself and stay mad. The only thing Tom wants to do is beat Ben, but he gets just so close and then something happens. It used to bother me, said Kite. He said of the adulation being heaped on Crenshaw while he, in fact, was leading the tournament and being largely ignored. It doesn't anymore. Everything you read is Crenshaw. He's got the charisma of Palmer, and it makes it that much more enjoyable to me if I beat him. because I'm thinking he's got all those guys out there watching him and they're all missing all of my good shots. So this is another little bit of a circus, NCAA. Kite complained it took almost 6 hours to play his round.
That's how long it takes now?
His concentration was shattered on the first tee when he waited over an hour because the tee times were late. He got to the first tee and had to wait more than an hour to go.
Unbelievable.
He blasted the NCAA for the tournament, for the way they ran the tournament. Stomped off for dinner. This is McDermott. Stomped off for a dinner of ground glass and poison. So why was he upset? Just about every tournament we played in, we finished 1-2, said Ben, in his motel room Friday night before the final round. He had missed the cut in this year's Open. So he'd missed the cut. And it was the first time he'd ever missed the cut in 7 professional tournaments. He's still a sophomore at UT.
Unreal.
First missed cut in a professional event. And they thought this like burned him up and motivated him. He lives and thinks golf so much of his waking day, he admits that he has a hard time being serious about his schoolwork. I think it'll take me 8 years to get my degree, he said. I'm just piddling around. It really is a farce. All through college, I've never had anything on my mind except golf. I can't get interested in anything else. Love that. It's a farce.
School's a farce, kids.
They were talking about it. The missed cut at the Open was on his mind, just burning him up.
It's amazing. This is his first missed cut. And he's 20
in a
years
pro
old.
Pro event.
And he's played in 7.
7 of them. So his sophomore year is not... Again, contrasting with Kite, it is not, he insists, a matter of style, particularly his own. Crenshaw hates to practice, and he pretends to know nothing of theory. Sometimes I get up to the ball and just think a little hook, but I don't think anything about where my hands are during the swing or stuff like that. You know, which may explain every now and then why he endures spells where his game are, you know, as vulnerable as a sandcastle in a rising tide.
Kind of similar to Sandy Lyle.
Even as a sophomore, he's like, you know, I just don't think about it. I was like, I'm going to hit a little hook, but I don't think about my hands that much or stance. So this is coming down the stretch against Kite. Kite's in the clubhouse. 18th hole. After a tepid tee shot that nestled troublesomely near a tree, Crenshaw pole hooked his second shot far left of the 18th green. He's 40 yards from the pin, and it's over. Kite's going to win. Only the courage of Palmer, the skill of Nicholas, and the touch of Jones could save him. Right? Kite knew better. He loped off to get a soft drink so that he could not see Crenshaw wedge weakly onto the green some 30 feet from the cup. So it's over. Kite's won, but no, Kite's like, he walks away. So he just kind of weakly wedges 30 feet away. Nor would he see Crenshaw wrap the putt boldly, dead on line. It smacked against the back of the cup, popped straight up in the air, and fell in the hole for the tie, the individual tie with Kite. Here's Houston's John Mills. Is he unreal? Is he unreal? He's a god. I figured he'd get it up and down because he always does, Kite said later. I just don't know how he does it. Neither does Ben. He just does it. Fascinating. So Kite is finally going to get like his moment to beat Ben, win the individual title. And, you know, he makes a 30-footer on the last hole.
It'd be so frustrating.
Back-to-back NCAA titles. 1973, I don't have a ton. He wins it again. You know, he's hyped as the greatest amateur record since Nicholas and the greatest amateur buildup since Nicholas. You know, for the record, third time he won the NCAA. He added 10 other championships, including the Western, the Southern, Northeast, Sunny Ana. You mentioned all those, and he won 11 of the 15 tournaments he entered.
So one thing of note.
Do you want to talk about his decision to turn pro?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And so the year before, he lost the USAM in the finals to Vinny Giles.
Legendary amateur from Virginia.
Yeah. So the next year he has to make a decision. Does he turn pro or does he play the amateur again and play the Walker Cup? And if he doesn't turn pro, he's got to wait another full year till he could turn pro because of the Q school deadline.
It's kind of nuts, right?
It wasn't like today.
So you couldn't turn pro in like January or November, like, right? You just, yeah. It doesn't operate that way. So he has to skip the Walker Cup, skips the U.S. Amateur, and he turns pro. Wins his first pro event. But again, last 1973, won 11 of 15 tournaments he entered. A bunch of very prestigious amateur events. College NCAA championships. And that's his... We spent a lot of time on that, but I think that's like a major, major part of his story.
Yeah.
Amateur game and UT legend.
I mean, it's crazy to say because he didn't win the USAM, but...
Right.
Arguably, outside of Bobby Jones, the greatest amateur golfer.
You don't have a career before you turn pro. That's not... That's... I don't know, even commonplace where people are saying you're the next Nicholas. You have the charisma of Palmer, you're the next Nicholas.
Like, I guess Tiger would be another one that...
Yep.
Tiger's yep. amateur record's probably better than Crenshaw's. But.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, we talk about a lot of these amateur careers, whether it's Sutton or Clampett, even last episode on the flashlight. But like this was a notch above. The hype, all these spotlights are on guys who are Hall of Famers or fringe Hall of Famers. Like they're great amateur players. But we're talking about someone who was a cut above as an amateur. Mm-hmm. And the hype kind of was commensurate with that. All right, so 1973, he turns pro, wins his first event. What was it? Texas Open, right?
Texas Open, San Antonio, wins by 4 shots, wins 25,000. Obviously, everybody, this is friends.
Again, just to be clear, this was after he won Q School by 12 freaking shots, as we alluded to at the start.
So just to give you an idea, obviously in his home state of Texas, but most this is from an article, the New York Times write up after. Most of the game's great names, including Jack Nicklaus, Palmer, Weisskopf, and Trevino, passed up on the tournament. But Crenshaw lured a record crowd of more than 20,000 to the final round. And the 60,000 total crowd for the week was the largest in the 44-year history of this event. So,
amazing. So I'm trying to like come up with a.
And like he won.
Some legendary like high school running back in Texas, right? Where obviously golf is big in Texas. Football is bigger. Football is bigger everywhere. But like, just a statewide legend, and he wins the Texas Open, drawing 20,000 people. Fascinating.
So he wins by 4. I can't remember who was finished second. I didn't write it down. But
that's fine.
Next week, 2 weeks later, next start, he goes to the World Open Golf at Pinehurst Number 2. This is the craziest tournament I've ever heard.
This is great. One of these benefits of these spotlights is like that Nabisco thing we were talking about, where there seems like a tour championship. 30 guys. This is a fun tournament. Joe Day.
$500,000 purse.
Massive. Wasn't it 100 grand maybe to the winner?
Yeah.
Something crazy.
He won. He came in second and got $47,000 or something like that. 41.
Richest purse ever. Professional game. Joe Day put it together. The prior PGA commissioner, or before there was a split. Go ahead.
So it was an 8-round tournament.
144 holes, 2 weeks in Pinehurst.
8 rounds.
Trevino didn't go. He's like, I'm not going for 2 weeks. I'm not going anywhere for 2 weeks. That's why he skipped it.
So Miller Barber wins. Mr. Yep. X was his nickname. He's actually a really good player.
Really good player. Really good player.
So he said, Barber wins, but he said of the young man from Austin, who is his principal challenger over Pinehurst Number 2 course today, it may take time, but in my opinion, he's another Nicholas.
He's the best that's come along since Nicholas. He's going to be the new gunner. I knew when I beat him that I'd done beat somebody. Second pro tournament ever for Crenshaw. Anything else you want to do on this event?
Yeah.
These guys all skipped it. Nicholas skipped it. Miller, Weisskopf, Trevino, they all skipped it. And it kind of left, Crenshaw a big, it was kind of a dud of an event. Jenkins was there writing it up, and then Miller, Crenshaw made it kind of brought some hype by charging at the end.
Turns out a 2-week, 8-round event did not hold people's attention.
He shot a 64, I think, on Pinehurst 2.
Nobody ended up under par over the 8 rounds.
He went 18 strokes off the lead into a tie for second after the 64. It said that this round under these conditions was probably the best ever on a course that has felt the cleats of the game's finest players for 50 years. So, and that's kind of where he gets into, you know, when I go back out east and play on some of the old historic courses, I get in this trance. And he talks about rounds at Pine Valley, Shinnecock.
Yeah, like 65 that. At Shinnecock, something.
I think 67 at Pine Valley, maybe. Yeah.
He's just lights up. He loved going and playing great golf courses. And that's becomes a trend where he would just leave tournaments and go play extra rounds at great courses around in the area. So one thing, so Jenkins wrote an SI article in 74.
Lee Trevino, cover.
Yeah.
Crenshaw made the cover. This was a cover story. Cover of SI in 1974. Hasn't won a major. Kind of incredible. Go ahead.
So Lee Trevino says he's got the best grip, the best setup, and the best swing I've ever seen. Besides that, he's nice. Johnny Miller. So after he beat Crenshaw to win his third tournament in a row, this is when Johnny Miller was on like just the heater of all heaters. I think this was in Arizona. He won those two tournaments, yeah. And then he won a third in a row. Wow, what a player he is. I didn't think I could hold him off. He has to be the best for his age there ever was. His personality is good, too good to be true. We may never know it, but down inside of him, there might be the cockiest killer there ever was.
Cockiest killer. I mean, again, these are Johnny Miller, who's already established. Lee Trevino, already very established guys, not prone to hyperbole.
It kind of reminds me of when we found that article with Ishikawa and the way people talked about Rory, like the way Tiger and Ogilvy and all of them talked about Rory. It's really similar to the way these all-time greats were talking about Ben Crenshaw.
So this is just real quick on that World Open before we move on. And this is of the same kind of vein. So it's kind of a dud missing the big guys, and Crenshaw makes it. It's like the great thing about a Crenshaw is that he gives golf an instant new hero, said Maurer, who is the organizer of the event. We need more, and then it won't be so important that you don't have Nicholas around. So he's kind of viewed as this like Nicholas replacement, and giving that event juice. All right.
So you want to get into the next big Crenshaw storyline?
What's that?
The near misses.
Okay. Can we just do Ben's Wrens real quick? Because this was a big part of this. Yeah. This was in the Jenkins article. Yeah. Like, so he's already on the tour. There's a reason they talk about Nicholas the game and Palmer the personality, right? He was like this instant marketable face, the mop of hair they talk about. And he had women following him everywhere. A lot of blondes. And they were called Ben's Bunnies initially. And then at some point, they were called Ben's Wrens, at which he said, Wrens is funnier than bunnies, said Crenshaw. And even I think one guy, and I think it might have been the World Open. It's something like, it's like, I'll take the leftover. I don't mind finishing second to him, and I'll take the leftover Wrens. Something, I forget who said that. I'm happy to finish second to him, everyone. I'm happy to finish second to him every week and pick up his cast off girls. So this is like his, you know, charm, charisma, appeal. Some golfers have it built in. This is Jenkins again, a Texas legendary Texas writer in Jenkins writing about a legendary Texas golfer. He's going to be drawn to him. Some golfers have it built in like a Palmer or Lee Trevino, and others acquire it as Nicholas and Hogan did by winning. Crenshaw and Daly has a built-in Palmer style, but he appears to be starting out with even more golfing ability than Palmer had. I don't know. That's it. The Ben's Wrens thing was just a big part of the mania around him, in addition to his amateur record.
He married very early, and he married a girl that was 18 at the time, or 17.
Yeah. Well, one article said she was 17, which, you know, had my radar up. And then another said she was 18. This later said she was 18.
So. She was a high school senior, though, because she skipped prom, you know, and just became, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff about, like, how the life of a tour wife is not, especially at this time, not glamorous. I mean, you're just essentially on their schedule and every waking day is about golf.
So he gives as many autographs as he gives, along with addresses and phone numbers, was what Jenkins said.
Unbelievable.
All right, let's get into the near misses you're talking about.
All right, 75 U.S. Open.
Medina.
He is tied for the lead on the 71st hole, long par 3 at Medina, hits 2-iron into the water, ends up making double bogey, misses out on a playoff between Lou Gramm and John Mahaffey.
Yep.
So this was
2-iron.
Not a great U.S. Open per Dan Jenkins. He does not like this U.S. Open at all.
Had Medina had many or any?
Yeah,
majors
they had
prior to this.
They had a few. Okay. Yeah. Uh huh. It was he wrote a pretty vapid intro to the piece about Lou Gramm's win. Who's
75 U.S. Open, Dan Jenkins.
Yeah. So that was his first miss. Then he finished. He had the 54 hole lead at the 77 Masters. This is after his great year where he has four wins in 76. He holds the 54 hole lead at the Masters. Doesn't get it done. 79. He's tied for the lead at the Open Championship on the 71st hole. Makes a double. 79 PGA, he loses to Gramm
in a
David Gramm, the Australian great player, in a playoff where Gramm makes putts of 25 feet, 15 feet in the playoff to stay alive, yeah. And then he wins on the third hole. But important to note, Gramm made a double on 18 to force the playoff. He shot 65 with a double
with
on
double.
18.
Crenshaw had a great quote about that. He was, pretty gracious in defeat. He's like, he got snake bitten in the playoff when Gramm made a 25 and 15 footer. He's like, but I can't imagine losing.
Here's his quote. I don't like second worth a damn, but I shouldn't have been in the playoff. David will be remembered as a man who shot a 65 on the last day of a major championship with a double bogey. And that's incredible. This is right after he lost a playoff for his major championship. And he's already at this point, like, is he ever going to win? He's starting to get this, like, this pressure building.
Incredible quote. And not just a playoff where, like, he played like shit. He got beat by a guy who came back on him with a 25-footer and a 15-footer to keep extending it.
Yeah, like, the 25-footer really was for par, and then the 15-footer was for birdie after Crenshaw already had a birdie in.
Tucked it. One quick thing. So you talked about Medina, how he hit the 2-iron short in the water on the 71st hole and missed the playoff by a shot. He won the Bing Crosby. He won Pebble the next year. And he was like going toe-to-toe with Nicholas at 76. And, he wasn't going. Nicholas shot like an 82 in the final round, but he was started on the lead. But he got to 17 and he was thinking about that Medina shot. And he pulled like an extra, like two extra clubs. He was like, I figured I couldn't hit it in the ocean. After coming up short on the 71st hole in Medina, he takes like, he hit a 5-iron at 17 at Pebble and then wins Bing Crosby. So he's winning on the tour during all these close calls. Mm-hmm. But a little snake bitten by some of these playoffs. That's what I didn't know. So like all these runner ups, it's not top tens. And spotlighting a lot of these guys, we see a lot of top tens, which is definitely an achievement. But these were, the trophy on his club on the 70th hole or 71st hole, really late in the game.
Yeah, so 76 Masters, he finished. So that U.S. Open, he finishes third, tied for third. 76 Masters, runner-up. 78 Open, runner-up. 79 Open, runner-up. 79 PGA, which was 3 weeks after the Open, runner-up. And then he has a runner-up in the 83 Masters, which...
It's unbelievable. So it's a Seve.
This is... Look at his Open Championship run, which I'm kind of surprised he didn't win, which I think he probably would have won something. He goes 77, T5, 78, T2, 79, T2, 83rd. I mean, like a four-year run there where ball bounces one way or another, he probably bags a win.
What was it? The Troon? He made a double on the 71st hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that Litham, you know, he was tied on the 71st hole.
Yeah.
You know, it's hit it into the bunker. So, like, yeah, or hit into the heather. Double bogey at Litham on the 71st hole. And same thing at Troon. Kind of incredible. So many close calls. Should we get to the breakthrough?
So then 83 Masters, he finishes T2nd. The year before 84, when he finally breaks through. So he shoots 68 on Sunday to beat Tom Watson by 2 shots. And guess who was leading heading into the final round?
Tom Kite, Texas brethren, Texas rival friends. It's still a little awkward, right?
I think they're like good friends now.
No, now. Yeah, but I mean, at this point, 84, yeah. It's still like, you know, not the closest. I think it seems more on Kite's end, right? Guy who's just frustrated. All right, so 1984 Masters, he wins. Finally, this, you know, we're talking 11 years after he won, turned pro, and had all the hype and had several close calls. Obviously, it wasn't like he'd been playing poor golf. Ton of close calls. Already a very stout, highly rated player on the PGA Tour. It's just like, will the major come? And he wins the 84 Masters.
It kind of reminds me of Phil.
That's not bad. Yeah, Phil, like, the legendary amateur, wins as an amateur on the PGA Tour.
Extraordinary amateur, and then just snake bitten in majors for a decade.
Yeah, it's a good comp. So he goes 67, 72, 70, 68 on Sunday to win the 84 Masters. I watched a little bit of this final round, and I thought it was interesting. Musburger starts as like, with setting the scene. He goes, a golfer by the name of Nick Faldo. Like, this is still, there were 47 players, I think, on the weekend playing. And like, Faldo, he made the 77 Ryder Cup. He's been a pretty great player already on the Euro Tour. But like, this American audience, all these guys aren't necessarily in the Masters. Like, a golfer by the name of Nick Faldo. It's 1984.
Well, this was the time where the only way you get into the Masters is if you win the European Tour Order of Merit.
Yep. So we talked about all these close calls, and, you know, he's in, what, the second to last group, maybe? One group ahead of
Kite? Second to last group.
And Jenkins talked about on Sunday he was the most popular golfer at the Masters since Arnold Palmer. Just so he's had those close calls. He's this kind of good-looking, charismatic person, and the crowd just starts going nuts for him. Do you want to get into any of the other scene, the people around him? There were a lot of gunners around him.
Lots of gunners. Lie.
Some Mark Lie, not necessarily a gunner.
I think that Jenkins, I have a tidbit from the Jenkins article that, I mean, it sums up just like, 5 times he had been a runner-up in a major, including last year's Masters won by Seve Ballesteros, while other players who were less talented and surely less popular had celebrated into the night. But this time he looked all week long like a young man with a purpose. And what he did in the last round of Augusta was make it all of the good things happen to him for a change. He played the best golf of his life from tee to green, avoided every catastrophe, and when he had to, he called on Little Ben, the best club in his bag. So I think the big thing here was that people started to say, like, this is where people started to doubt his swing, where they were saying, like, it went from the greatest swing they've ever seen to, oh, it's too long, it produces loose shots under pressure, and in this major, he really like buckled down, and in 82, he had a horrible year. It was his worst year as a pro, and he had started to really doubt his swing, and he went back to Austin for like 3 weeks. People thought he was going to quit the game, and he went back to Austin for 3 weeks, and like, they just went back to just trusting his swing.
Yeah, that 82, he fell off a cliff, right?
Yeah.
People were telling me all kinds of things to try and help, he says, but then it was going in one ear out the other. Golfer always looks for quick cures, patch up one little part of his game, so better for 1 week, one day, one shot. I'll be on the practice tee, and I see somebody coming toward me. I think he's going to say something about my swing. I'll just go to the other end of the practice tee. I was a basket case.
So
82.
He only had 2 top 10s in 1982 on tour, which, like, to give you an idea, the years leading up to 82, he had 8, 10, and 9 top 10s with wins in all those years. And then 82, he has 2 top 10s, no wins.
Just a little bit about the searching, too. This is a great, I mean, it's very different from Bryson or even Clampett, obviously, with the golfing machine, Faldo, breaking it down with Ledbetter. He talks about how he got back to winning this 84 Masters, that kind of quality of play. He goes, I haven't thought about my swing one iota. After all those years, I was determined to aim more consistently, to allow my instincts and my muscles to work. Take instinct away from golf and there's nothing. You can't play any kind of shot. How can you chip over a bunker that's 40 yards away? How can you hit a ball in a wind? All that stuff. You can't do it by mechanics. And this is just like, he's like a feel guy. People were getting at him about his long, loose swing. He was just like, this is a game of instinct. And Penick said this to him. Harvey said this to him. He goes, Ben Hogan didn't have the prettiest swing in the world, but Ben Hogan knew his game better than anyone else knew theirs. And get back to your game, play it, live it, do not change it. And it hit home, Crenshaw said. He goes to 84 Masters, he wins. He goes, I can live with myself now. So we got through those basket case years, quote.
So at Austin Golf Club, Crenshaw grew up playing Austin Country Club. Austin, yeah. Golf Club, there's no yardage on any sprinkler heads.
Interesting.
And my rangefinder didn't have, the battery died when I played there.
Was it on meters? No.
Okay. No, it died. So I was completely blind, but that's like how Crenshaw grew up playing with no yardages. He wouldn't look, he was all feel. So here at Austin Golf Club, he doesn't have any yardages on the, because he thinks player, it should be feel based.
Okay. Fantastic. That's awesome anecdote. All right, 84 Masters. So he had that basket case years. He's back to doing it all by feel. And he, you know, again, according to Jenkins, like people always give him, he's the greatest putter of all time. Little Ben this, little Ben that. But like what he was really proud of and what Jenkins tried to highlight in his game story was like this was done by playing golf shots, tee to green. He was striping it. And of course, there were birdies, like the putter came in handy. And the big highlight is he made a 60-foot birdie on the 10th hole. I think Bob Murphy was on the broadcast, said it was the greatest putt he'd ever seen. He made a 12-foot birdie at the 12th, and then a 15-footer to save par at 14. I watched him on 14. He like hooked it pretty hard at the top level on the left side of the green. And he's like cursing, pissed off. And then his lag, like, how are you going to lag it? It's a front right, way down. Like, maybe it was a good lag. Probably was a good lag. Maybe not for him. But and then he makes the 15-footer, and, like, Faldo's, like, shaking his head on 14. Go ahead. It looks like you want that.
No, I think it was a great way to win. Like, it was a great way to win because he played better than everybody and just didn't have anything bad happen, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he talks I've put too much pressure on myself. There's no question about it. And this is from Jenkins. I love golf and golf history. I've dreamed of winning major championships. I've wondered when it was ever going to happen to me. I'd thought 2 years ago that it would never happen. I guess you can say this is more of a relief than anything.
Wow.
Golf is the hardest game in the world to play well. And as soon as you start thinking you're somebody else or somebody special, it'll teach you a lesson. Even the golf historian Crenshaw recalled words of Bobby Jones and quoted him, "You swing your best when you have the fewest things to think about."
Amazing. Just another thing about the back nine. He laid up on 13.
Yeah.
He's like, I think he was too clear of kite. He looked back, saw kite, had hit it in the water at 12. Then he thought he saw Billy Joe Patton in the crowd at like the corner at 13. And Patton obviously was best amateur chance to win it and hit it in the water on 13 and 15. And he thought he saw Patton like up somewhere on the corner. I don't know if it was in the crowd or it was like a walking official, whatever it was. And he decided to lay up on 13 and made his par. He birdied 15, I want to say. And beat Watson by two. It was just interesting. Like it was a loaded group around him, and Jenkins wrote about that, saying, you know, he was eight players were within four shots of kite 18 players were within 6 strokes of the lead to start it. And this was after they finished up on Sunday. Big rain on Saturday. They had to come out and play Sunday morning. You know, Kite was at 207, Lai at 208, Crenshaw, Faldo, and Graham were at 209, and Watson, who was at 210, he got in the clubhouse, as was Larry Nelson. So, like, a lot of major championship power ahead of him. So, and Crenshaw had yet to win it. So, and he just kind of, he took it by the throat. There was some, they're like, eh, he's still got to play 18, and he just kind of made a clean par to hang on against Watson, who was a major championship caliber player at that point. Anything else on 84 Masters? You want to talk about the divorce? Because this was happening.
Yeah, this happened.
As it was going on. Here's Jenkins. It is an awkward thing to discuss now, but the best thing Crenshaw had going for him was peace of mind. It may have been the result of his putting his marital discord out of his life. His roommates most of the week were country and western stars, the Gatlin brothers, and not his wife, Polly. Long admired as one of the tour's prettiest wives. Jenkins loved writing about the wives.
Oh, yeah.
The new Masters champion
especially
and Polly.
Couples.
Yeah. Polly, who was in the Virgin Islands, are separated, headed for a divorce that has been on again, off again during the past few years of Crenshaw's turbulent career. Polly and Ben were the Hollywood couple of the tour. She was the lead Wren, a gorgeous blonde who married Ben when she was 17 and tried to learn as much about Harry Vardon as she knew about the Rolling Stones. She gave up college proms for a guy who put it on hotel carpets. And so perhaps from the beginning, this tour marriage wasn't going to be an easy one. So she filed for divorce, I think, in Greensboro, when he was in Greensboro, a week or two before the Masters. But it was like a totally amicable divorce. There was one article I read about how CBS came to do like a story on his Masters win, like at his home in Austin, like a week or two, maybe a month later. And Polly was there, and like, Ben and his parents and Polly agreed that she probably shouldn't be in the interview, but Polly wanted to stay there and sat off camera and wanted to hear him talk about winning. Like, it was like still very friendly, amicable divorce. But apparently, according to Jenkins, like, it added to the sort of peace of mind of the week. Anything else on 84 Masters you want to talk about?
That's it, I think. So 85.
Wait, real quick though, can I just say?
Yeah.
There was a reason why it was so popular as Palmer. Like, he had the most friends on the PGA Tour. Like, so many friends. Everyone loved him. And they had this big dinner for him in Austin a week later. His grace through his loan ordeal, all these close calls, as he has carried increasingly the heavy burden of his own and others' expectation, has inspired more admiration than most golfers, no matter how successful, can expect in a lifetime. His agony when he was on the golf course was palpable, even through the filter of a television camera, but he always left it there. The blame for his failures remained in the only place an honest golfer can put it, not in the rough or a caddy's error or nature's heartless whims, but inside his own tortured head. For his opponents and the rest of us, there was always a big Texas grin. Crenshaw seemed sorrier for what he was putting his friends through than he was himself. So that was a decade of close major wins. A little bit with Phil, like the decade with close major wins. And he quotes Bobby Jones at St. Andrews, just talking about friendship and how many friends on tour have helped him through it. And he finally gets his 84 Masters. All right.
All right.
Moving on.
85. 82 was the worst year of his career to date. 85 becomes the worst next. No top tens. And
yep.
They're rapidly losing weight, and nobody knows what's going on. He doesn't understand what's happening. He's got no energy. Almost ends his career, and it turns out he's diagnosed with Graves' disease, which is a thyroid disease. So Diaz, in an SI article, after he won the Masters, and by the time he had overcome it 2 years later, he was a gaunt, less powerful player. So this really affects him.
And his putting kind of went a little bit in 85 too.
So this is Crenshaw from that New York Post article about Jose Reyes.
Yeah.
I can remember how I felt, and it was not good. Very jittery and kind of a nervous feeling. Crenshaw said it wasn't until after 4 or 5 months of experiencing symptoms that he was diagnosed. After visiting the University of Texas Nuclear Medicine Department, Crenshaw began taking radioactive iodine, iodine as a treatment for his hyperthyroidism. Because of his condition, Crenshaw's golf game declined. I didn't play well at all, Crenshaw said. It affected my physical being. Specifically, Crenshaw found his short game hurting. For putting or chipping, his nervousness and jitters made it difficult to find his touch. Crenshaw's health eventually improved because of the iodine. After 3 or 4 months, once taking the iodine and subsequent tests, I started to feel like myself again, he said.
Wow. That was it. Like, that was the most perplexing part about, so he, the year after he wins the Masters, there's a Barry McDermott article. He's like 144th putting, whatever putting statistic. You know, he was like missing all these cuts. He, according to McDermott, folks had taken to calling him Mental Ben instead of Gentle Ben. And he's just like, he was throwing Little Ben to the ground at Memorial. He kicked Little Ben, his magic wand. And he was just missing a lot of cuts. His putting had gone on him. While we're on the subject of health, and you talk about the Graves disease, he had a broken toe. Did you get that part?
I didn't see that.
For years, undiagnosed, and this was a big problem in 95 when he won, he had like a toe issue that bothered him for years. And he says it's from 1979 when he kicked a garbage can or a bucket coming off the green at Colonial.
Unbelievable.
And it bothered him. He had a sore toe for like a decade. It was like really acute in 95. It was claimed, it was characterized as a broken toe later. He walked, he said it himself, 1979, I walked off the green and kicked a big trash barrel so hard that I'm still paying for it. I've had surgery on the big toe on my right foot once and probably will again because the toe is arthritic. I've developed some back problems from walking on the side of my foot because of the toe. That was going into like 95, they were talking about that. But he kicked the can, he said, in 1979.
Yeah.
So, that and the Graves disease. 85, is, you know, it's gone. Putting's gone. He's really struggling. All right. Anything else? Go ahead.
Masters, he led on the back nine in 87. Bogeyed 17 and missed a playoff by a shot. 87 Ryder Cup, he lost a really big singles match to Eamon Darcy. He was one up with two to play. So he started, then people started to give him this rep of he couldn't win. You know, he couldn't win the big thing. He was just kind of a choker.
87, he lost the playoff to TC Chen at Riviera. Mm-hmm. And Riley called him, Ben Crenshaw may go down as the most loved player, yet the most pathetic playoff performer in history. He is 0 for his career. He said, my playoff record is pitiful. I have no idea why. He talks about that one at Riviera. Chen made some putt on top of him to force extra holes. And he's like, he just put his head in his hands. He like knew it was done. Like missed a four-footer and lost the Riviera. So again, struggling. Some close calls, but struggling. That's 87.
89 Masters. He bogeys 18 to miss the playoff by a shot. So, you know, these are just killers.
So many more chances. Go ahead.
So in 93, I found this this quote about his golf, about his best golf. And I think this was, I can't remember. I'm sorry, I didn't write this down.
No, you're good. Let's go.
He kept his pain private and never became bitter. I really do feel in my heart that in high school and college, I played my best golf.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Maybe I didn't think, I just did, but it doesn't bother me anymore that I didn't turn out to be whatever. I think this was the Diaz
95
article in SI.
Yep, I played my best golf. I mean, think about that though, and we may be seeing that with Spieth. I don't know. Like, obviously, Crenshaw had a great pro career after this, but thinking that you played your best golf when you were 18, 19, 20. And then the expectations with having to do that on the front end, the burdens that come with that. And I think that's what they talked about with the 95 Masters.
Yeah. It's in 92, he wins the Western Open. That was right after his clubs got stolen. And there were
I forgot. Go ahead.
You go ahead.
I forgot to mention, in 84 Masters, there was a story, I think Bamberger said he went to Palmetto, like Palmetto Golf Club, after... I can't remember if it was before the after the third round or after his first round, but during the tournament, he goes to Palmetto just to kind of check it out, like, you know, soak in the history. I don't know if he played. He may have played.
He did play.
I'm not sure. I think he
loved
did play
it. Palmetto. He was entranced by the Stanford White clubhouse. He just is. So you'd routinely go in mid tournaments. Like, he'd play around, and then he'd go hightail it to a course nearby. I've got a couple tidbits on that. So, Chicago Golf Club, he's an honorary member there. And the club historian, John Moran, great guy, actually caddied there growing up. This is John Moran caddies for him in 1980, July 4th, 1980. I cart caddied for Stick, Don Stickney, who's a local legend, skinny guy, played golf at Ohio State with Weisskopf. Stick, Ben Crenshaw, Tom Weisskopf, Ed Snead, who just, you know, it was off of his collapse in the 79 Masters, in an exhibition for the members. Stick not only played at Ohio State with Weisskopf, but apparently Weisskopf had lived in Stick's house for a period of time during college. Anyway, when they finally arrived from their tournament rounds at Butler, they jumped directly on the first tee. Ben blocked his opening tee shot into the far right rough up towards the 18th tee. In Chicago golf lore, this is where he played a mulligan and happily went on to shoot 62 from that ball. Having been there, however, I know that while he hit the second ball that someone flipped to him, Ben played his original ball, hit a 4-iron to the green. Newer members might be surprised to know that by July 4th, the then 2-inch bluegrass rough would have been burned out. He had a beautiful lie, hit a beautiful shot with his first tee ball. He finished 3-3-3 to break the course record by 2 shots.
This is a morning after playing Butler?
No, the afternoon after playing Butler.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He had already played 18 at Butler in tournament golf, and he goes to... Wow.
1980. The balls used all four players that day are now in the history room. I've got a picture of it on the website if you search Chicago Golf. And he breaks the course record by 2 shots. But because of he hit the second ball off the tee, it's not the official course record.
Got it. But he played
the original ball.
4-iron. Wow. That's a good story.
Another thing. So up until Ben Crenshaw in the mid to late 80s, Crystal Downs was just like a hidden gem. Nobody knew about Crystal Downs.
Yeah.
So this is from the Alistair McKenzie site, Society site. Crystal Downs was often referred to as Michigan's hidden gem by a small group of avid golfers who recognized the significance of the course's heritage. So this Crystal Downs, Alistair McKenzie, Perry Maxwell design in northern Michigan, that's like one of the 15 best courses in the country. And thrilled at annual pilgrimages to the course, experienced the speedy undulating greens, rhythmic routing, sparkling lake views, and challenging play. The lack of notoriety changed in 1986, though, when a young Ben Crenshaw took the day off from the Buick Open being held 230 miles south at Warwick Hills in Grand Blanche, Michigan, to take a private jet to Frankfurt and experience Crystal Downs with a local acquaintance. Not only did Ben go on to win that year's Buick Open, but he followed his victory with public comments and articles about the great time at Crystal Downs and his admiration for the course's design. By 1989, fueled by greater publicity, expanding interest in golf, and good economic times, Crystal Downs reached full membership and began to accumulate a substantial waiting list.
Wow. So Palmetto, during the Masters... Chicago Golf during, was it the Western Open, I assume? And during the Buick, he's going up to Crystal Downs and kind of brings, not back on the map. It was always...
No, it wasn't on the map.
Yeah.
It wasn't in any rankings or anything until...
Oh, right. The architecture crowd knew of its importance. Some. But Crenshaw.
Yeah, like, he told Tom Doak about it. Like, it's kind of crazy. Like, there's all this... But two of those tournaments, he won.
Yeah.
Palmetto.
Well, the Masters. Yeah, Masters. And the Masters.
Yeah, Masters and the Buick. He wins the week that he goes on his expeditions during the tournament.
Unbelievable. All right. Should we get to what you have anything on the early 90s before we go to 95 Masters? I feel like we've go for it. You got it. You look like you're.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, he's a history buff. He's obsessed with courses, architecture, golf history.
Bobby Jones, quoting Bobby Jones all the time.
One other thing I picked up, he was also a bird watcher.
Yeah, I saw that.
He courts ridicule on the tour whenever he gets excited over spotting a scarlet tanager at Muirfield Village or a bald eagle at Ponte Vedra. So just interesting guy.
Talked about like his buddy was into it or something. His high school friend. He just got into it on the golf course. Maybe his teammate or something. But now he took shit for it on tour when he's like get excited about seeing a bird.
There's another Jenkins article that just talked about, I think one of the things with Crenshaw was he was just such an interesting guy off the course, you know?
Yeah. Seems like a real contemplative. That's why he was popular.
He liked to have a good time too, you know? Yeah. He was known as a somebody that would throw back a few, and he'd show up at the course with a cigarette, and you know.
Right. Well, that's the whole thing. Like, you want someone who seems whip smart, an appreciation of history, contemplative, and like friend, but also like not just a pent up sort of nerd. Right. He had fun too. He kind of had the whole package as a person. It seems like. All right. Should we move to 95? Anything else?
You hit
your
else.
Bird watching? 95, of course, like his game isn't what it was, right? This is far from the early 70s, the mid 80s. You know, 95, he wins the Masters. I did find an interesting old Rosefort article about how he had shunned the Vass irons.
Oh, the Corey Pavin.
Yeah.
Gritty little Bruins irons.
Yeah. One player who can't be accused of misleading the public is Ben Crenshaw. So this was on equipment. When Cleveland Classics, whose irons he had played and endorsed, went the radically shaped Vass iron in 94, Crenshaw, the traditionalist, just couldn't make the switch. He went back to an old set of Walter Hagens, and his bag is generic. No logo on it. In golf, it's as rare as a double eagle. So he goes to 90. I don't know. I think that was the case in 95 Masters, because the article's from 95. He shuns the Vass and has Hagen irons.
One funny thing on that, I just forgot. In the Western Open that he won, the 92, his strap broke on his bag, so that he was using a Dubstrad, like a Coghill Dubstrad bag that like barely could fit his rain suit. So his caddy's like this little carry bag. He wins the 92 Western Open with.
They just bought in the pro shop or whatever.
Yeah. Wow.
Amazing. Okay, so we get to 95 Masters. He comes to it. He'd missed three cuts in his last four starts. He hadn't broken 70 in 2 months. He was 69th on the PGA Tour in putting. This is from Rick Riley. But then on Tuesday before the tournament, his longtime Augusta caddy, Carl Jackson, a man who would need two woofer implants just to be considered quiet, said out of the blue, "Put the ball a little back in your stance, Ben, and you got to turn your shoulders more." So he was, this is like the toe thing. He said he was like compensating for the hurt toe. So Carl Jackson's giving, he hadn't played well. Carl Jackson's giving him swing tips. After hitting four balls, Crenshaw said he was suddenly striping it again. Four balls. "I've never had a confidence transformation like that in my life," said Crenshaw. So that's some of the stuff around his game. You want to get to the obvious.
Yeah, the
obvious,
Harvey like,
personal. Yeah.
Dies on April 2nd. The kite and
Sunday.
Him. Yeah.
Allegedly, Penick clapped for Davis Love won, I think, Zurich or whatever the event in New Orleans was. And Love's dad, Davis Love Jr., was obviously a Penick protege. Allegedly clapped for DL3's win and then passed away on that Sunday. Go ahead.
So he flies, him and Kite fly back to Augusta from the funeral service on Wednesday night.
They go Wednesday morning, the Penick's funeral, fly from Augusta and then back to Augusta again Wednesday night. They said he went to the range that night after the funeral and was like hitting balls And, you know, it was like late Wednesday night, sort of like cool setting. He'd obviously just buried his like close friend and mentor. Carl was there. They just said like the scene was really cool. Late night before the master starts, day of the funeral, just kind of cool. Cool scene, or not cool, but you know what I mean. A mystical scene, so to speak.
And then like the whole thing, the whole week was that Harvey was there because, you know, it ended up being Crenshaw and Davis Love coming down the stretch at the tournament.
Right, right, right. He talked about, you know, at the service, Pennock's service, Tinsley Pennock, Harvey's son, took his father's old wooden Gene Saracen putter and saved it for Crenshaw. It was the same putter that on the last Sunday in March, Pennock, lying in a hospital bed in his bedroom at home, had commanded Crenshaw to get from the garage. So like, so Crenshaw goes and gets the putter from his garage, brings it back to Pennock laying in his bed and shows it to him. He shows, checks the grip, has Crenshaw do the grip and checking Crenshaw's grip from his hospital bed with Saracen's old putter. And he goes, just trust yourself. Pretty cool. Like, this is the month before he dies. So Crenshaw goes back to Augusta Wednesday night. You know, he's just like drained. You know, he just buried him. He's hitting balls. He's getting these swing tips from Carl. And he says, like, the next morning he just woke up and it was just like, there was a calmness. This was his wife. There was a calmness to him all week that I've never seen before. And then every break went his way, which his wife, Julie, who he met in the gallery at Riviera, I believe. That was his second wife, Julie. I want to say it was late 80s, 89, 87, somewhere in there.
A late Wren.
Yeah. Julie, who seems awesome, by the way. She seems amazing based on the stories I read. Just like, there was a Shipnuck article this year about how they were sipping wine out of the plastic Masters souvenir cups. And she's like cracking about rewatching the 95 Masters. She seems just like fantastic person. So Crenshaw, you know, Julie starts calling him Harvey bounces all week. So he hit it, I guess, one in the middle of the bunker on eight. I think it was Thursday early in the week that popped out. It was like a bunker. Balls never pop out of that bunker. Happened, I think, on two on Sunday.
Yeah.
He like hooked one hard into the trees, right? Was it left? He hooked it? That hit out of the trees and then bounced into the middle of the fairway. It was like probably going to be a double bogey. Goes in the middle of the fairway. Several of those things where so he has this calmness and all these Harvey bounces, of which Julie kept calling them. And here's Riley. What's weird is that this does not start out as Crenshaw's week at all. The first of 2 days of the tournament belonged to a 19-year-old dervish known as Tiger Woods, the U.S. amateur champ playing his first Masters and only the fourth black American to compete in the event. He changed the face of the tournament literally. This year, you did not have to look for a white caddy in overalls to find a black face. They were everywhere in Woods' teaming galleries. They were there to take a sip of golf history. So Tiger, they talk about Tiger like hitting sand wedges into 18. And just like, this is couples and DL3 are like, this is a different kind of game he's playing in terms of his distance. And that was like, he stole the show as an amateur the first 2 days of Crenshaw's win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything else, you know, before we get to like the finals on Sunday?
Our theme of little people, Riley bashing on little people, the leader
there
was Brian Henniger.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Would the winner be Henniger, a man so small and Webelo face that one
Webelo
Webelo, I don't know, Webelo face that once at the Western Open he drove up to the valet parking in his courtesy car and Sue Price, Nick Price's wife, got in the front seat thinking her driver had arrived.
One more thing on Tiger. Apparently, like, he was really downplaying Augusta, and they didn't know if this was like the race thing or just trying to be too cool. You know, from Riley, he goes, when asked if he was awed or thrilled by Augusta, he shrugged and said, "It's just another tournament." And by what about Magnolia Lane? "It was just a short drive. I thought it would be longer." And he goes, "What about the crow's nest?" He goes, "I don't know. I came in late, threw my bag down, and went right to sleep." So Tiger being like too cool with the press, but apparently, like, he was just loving it. It was like sneaking around the clubhouse trying to take in all the history snuck into the champions locker room. All right. Sunday, 95 Masters. 23 players representing 9 green jackets were crammed into a 7-shot bunch. But by the end, all of which 3 players were left in a green jacket raffle. The red-hot pairing of Love and Norman. So, I mean, DL3 and Norman. Big
guys,
I
think guys that had some Sunday issues.
Yeah. And DL3, I think, got in this tournament by winning the Zurich or New Orleans. I think he was kind of on a tough streak and needed to win to get in a week before. So it's Crenshaw, Love, and Norman by the end.
Those guys were like the mailman.
Yeah. Crenshaw was 45 minutes behind them. You love your NBA stuff. They were tied at 12 under. Love carried a 7-iron too far on 16. He goes, sometimes you wonder if things aren't meant to be. That shot went 4 or 5 yards farther than I should be able to hit and stayed up on the top of the hill. He 3-putted. On the 4-4, 17th, Norman had the easiest 106-yard sand wedge you could want, and he blew it 40 feet to the left of the hole and 3-putted. What in the world was going on? And Crenshaw, like, so Love and Norman just opened it up for him. Crenshaw afterwards says, I believe in fate. I don't know how it happened. I don't. Love, by the way, his 13 under 275 was the lowest score not to win the Masters, which I think we talked about on the Love throwback last week. Anything else on this win? I didn't have a lot on the actual round other than Crenshaw like getting some bounces, and there's the Harvey story.
Yeah, that was kind of it. I think Diaz in that article he wrote the week after said, well, I think like, so this is his last win as a pro.
Yeah. Oh, one quick though. He made only 5 bogeys and not a single double the whole week. So it's not like we have this 60-footer on 10, like an 84, but he just kind of teed to green, kept the putter going, and he talked about how he was couldn't believe it. It's like, I've never made only 5 bogeys in an event in my life. So go ahead. This is Diaz.
Diaz, while Crenshaw would be embarrassed by the comparison, he has followed the model of his idol, Bob Jones, of whom Herbert Warren Wind once wrote, as a young man, he was able to stand up to just about the best that life can offer, which isn't easy, and later he stood up with equal grace to just about the worst.
Kind of amazing. This is a Bill Fields article that was recent, so he's looking back. I can't believe to this day I played that well on that particular week. As I've said many times, it's unexplainable. I played the whole week with only 5 bogeys. I've never done that in a major. I had a very even-keel attitude. And more Fields. The themes of that week have been well documented. Jackson giving them a tip, Crenshaw using his friend and business manager Scott Sayers' Cleveland facsimile of Little Ben. So he used his friend's putter that was like a facsimile of Little Ben. And, you know, his largely dormant season came to life. And they talk about him at the rental house on the Sunday. His brother Charlie Crenshaw comes in. And they play basketball in the driveway that morning. And before Crenshaw left for the course for the final round, he went to the end of the driveway. And before they leave, he goes to the end of the driveway, just stood, thinks, and like thinking about what happened, plotting the day. And he remembers clearly the lone figure standing at the end of the driveway, thinking about Penick and what could happen that Sunday. All right. Anything else?
I think
at 95.
That's it for 95.
His last win. Last pro win.
And then next big thing was the 99 Ryder Cup, the famous Brookline Ryder Cup. Maybe the worst shirts of all time, but the greatest Ryder Cup comeback of all time.
That's a good point. You know, those shirts were inspired by what he wore at 95. He wore a similar 95 shirt of like Bobby Jones, like picture frames.
Yeah.
Of Bobby Jones. And then they used it for the Ryder Cup in 99. We're going long here.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I think like most people know the 99 Ryder Cup story, but he was getting blasted for his early round pairings. And then they come back and now, you know, then he's remembered as a great Ryder Cup captain. It's like what we talk about with Ryder Cup captaincy. If you win, you're celebrated. If you don't, you're the worst captain ever.
Yeah. This was really like the turn, like where his captains became a big deal. And the big thing was at the PGA at Medina, with the whole should they be paid, the 4 that wanted to be paid, Duval, yeah. O'Meara, Mickelson, and Woods. I mean, Crenshaw made this public and got kind of, you know, the players took the heat because he made it public, and John Garrity ripped Crenshaw for this. So Crenshaw's quote is, "It burns the hell out of me to listen to some of their viewpoints. Every fine player who's worth his salt has given his heart and soul to the Ryder Cup on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm personally disappointed in a couple of people." So he said that on Wednesday before the PGA at Medina. The next day, this is Garrity, "You had to love Crenshaw even more the next day when he doubled the estimated number," so he's a couple people, "of the miscreants and confirmed their names, Tiger, Duval, Phil, and O'Meara. By doing so, he widened the fissure between the flag wavers and the accountants on his team, exposed as the gain of four to withering public criticism and poured kerosene on a fire the PGA of America and the PGA Tour were frantically trying to put out. That's leadership," a Chicago journalist wrote, "of without a trace of irony. Well, yeah, if your definition of a good leader is General Custer at Little Bighorn." So Garrity really crushing him. "What Crenshaw did was hurt professional golf. The public generally teeters between two perceptions of pro golfers. The last independent, noble, truth-telling, rules-abiding figures in sports, or just like all the other spoiled, bratty jocks who pollute the air with their whining. With his undisciplined remarks at Medina, Crenshaw tipped almost everyone into the second camp. And like the backlash was immediate." Mickelson, Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Tribune. Mickelson now outed as one of these guys who wants cash or thinks they should be getting a cut to give to charity. He got blasted in the Chicago Tribune for a self-important act. Here's a caddy in the article quoted. "He puts on any more weight," an anonymous caddy was quoted as saying, "and he won't be able to get his little fat head through the Learjet of his and it have to fly commercial. And wouldn't that be a shame?" So Crenshaw caught a lot of crap for sort of, I guess they had some team meeting with these behind the scenes fighting about whether they should be paid. And they're like, no one's talking about this. And Crenshaw kind of then went out and made allusions to it in his press conference and then named them the next day. And Garrity didn't like that because of all the backlash it sent towards Woods, Phil, O'Meara, and Duval. Duval, I guess, was really, really hurt by it more than anybody. Phil and Tiger were like, it's all right. We like Ben. He's a good leader. But Duval seemed kind of pretty hurt by it, and it motivated him to play well at Brookline. So there was just, I read more on that, the whole pay to play thing, than the cup.
I mean, his famous thing was, I'm a big believer in fate. I have a good feeling about this. And then, you know, the flurry of wind came.
One note too, this was the start of really tinkering with the course, mm-hmm. according to Diaz. Like, so Crenshaw's obviously this traditionalist, but you know, they talked about how like Seve would jump around in carts. And he wrote, "Ben Crenshaw, this year's American captain, is too smart to worry about cart speed. So with little fanfare, he's put his mind to something quite tangible that could determine the outcome of next week's Ryder Cup. He has altered the country club course in a way that sure the most talented team wins. Crenshaw has had the fairways widened and the rough cut to a wispy 3 inches. He wants his players to attack the course with their drivers and play short irons into country club's tiny greens. He wants to see a lot of birdies," which totally played into like Duval and Tiger. And they talked about how, like, you know, Brookline's Brahmins haven't reacted well to all this tinkering. They make it sound as if Francis we met's amateur status has been revoked. But while no one loves the old world cragginess of the country club more than Crenshaw, he knows that the Ryder Cup is too important to put the romance ahead of pragmatism. He wants Duval, Love, Mickelson to freewheel and blow the doors off of the plotters, the European plotters. Thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a guy who knows architecture, but also knows this competition. Like because it was contrast to Oak Hill in 95, which they set up as a U.S. Open, thinking like the Euros, Seve hits it everywhere. But now they have these power hitters. And he's like, I'm going to widen the fairways. I'm going to cut the rough to 3 inches.
He knows what he's, you know, the most skilled players will win when it's set up that way.
Yeah.
All thick rough does is just muddy the skill.
I would this is a major part of his legacy. I liked the night before in the Four Seasons, the night before the comeback. It was Crenshaw, his wife, all the players, their wives, his two assistant captains, Texans Bill Rogers and Bruce Litsky, and George W. Bush, presidential candidate, scion of two past USGA presidents. We know all that. He read a poem about remembering the horrible massacre at the Alamo. When the hopes of Texas independence from Mexico appeared dead, and yet, as every Texan knows, independence came just 6 weeks. A video was shown. This is Saturday night. It included highlights from each player's career and a personalized cheer by a cheerleader from each player's college. It's amazing what $64 million in Ryder Cup revenues can do, can buy, according to Bamberger. The video also included a scene from Animal House. You know, was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor, which Steve Pate loved. And everybody in the room was asked to speak about his Ryder Cup experience. Most said something to inspire the team, and Hal Sutton said, "I believe there's more talent on the sixth floor," they were staying on the sixth floor of the Four Seasons, "than there is in the fifth. But we've got to play with more emotion. We've got to raise our fists and get the crowd into it." Payne, so that's what we saw all day Sunday, right? Duvall going nuts. People are getting, like, there's Americans trying to get the crowd into it. You know, one player, when they were talking in the Saturday meeting, said, like, should we win tomorrow? Crenshaw interjected, "When we win tomorrow." So I just thought that scene of Saturday night at the Four Seasons after they've lost. And Crenshaw's strategy had been questioned quite a bit. You know, the team out.
The Elmira benching. So, I mean, I think...
A man after your own heart with the Elmira stuff.
He knows golf, you know? I think that's the final kind of chapter of his competitive career, really.
Yeah, but a significant chapter.
Yeah.
And should we talk about legacy at all?
I mean, architecture-wise,
you have to add that. It has to be a piece of this.
Yeah, he's his Core and Crenshaw firm is, you know, could a lot of people could put him on their Mount Rushmore of architects. Like, you know, in the discussion of greatest modern architect.
And a real, I mean, this is your expertise, but as I understand it, like, how they influenced the direction. Yeah. It wasn't just like improving upon something that was thought to be good. It was changing directions, right?
It was
really kind of influencing directions.
He and Bill Core, Tom Doak, really were the ones that pushed architecture in a new direction. And I think like their design at Sandhills, Mullen, Nebraska, Dick Youngscap, the great developer, golf course, that really was the thing that kind of put a new style of architecture on the map. It became automatically one of the best courses in the world. Ironically, I think Bill Core told me that he thought it was crazy when he got the call about Sandhills, like in the middle of Nebraska. But Crenshaw, he talked to Ben, and Ben remembered seeing something in a National Geographic about the terrain of the Sandhills in Nebraska, and he's like, "Oh, we should go look at this." And obviously Kapalua was their first big project together, which has been a mainstay of the tour, but you know, the really great architects and you know, from like an architecture standpoint, would have a chance at the Hall of Fame of architects.
You talked a bit about Core there, and I think he's probably told this on your podcast. I read an article about like when they first started the team up, Ron Witten went down to Barton Creek and was talking to him. Was like, "What's the name of the company?" And they didn't have a name. They had to think about it. And Crenshaw like just blurts out, "Core Crenshaw." And that always had a huge impact on Core. Is like, you have like one of the greatest players, the greatest amateurs of all time, a Masters champion. I think this was mid-80s, late-80s at this point, mm-hmm, when they teamed
late
up.
Late-80s.
So he'd won the Masters already. And like, it should be like, Core's like, "Who does that? Who, first of all, who puts me first? Who even includes my name?" It should be like Crenshaw and Associates, maybe. But he said, he just blurted out Core Crenshaw, and that was the name of the design. And it kind of speaks to Ben's obviously like popularity off the course and his graciousness.
And I think there's like everybody, a lot of people in architecture will say, "Oh, it's all Bill Core," but I think like there's so much with that partnership that you don't know unless you're out there. But Ben is obviously, Core is more the day-to-day, but Ben does a lot of the editing, the visiting, and you know, visits and walks and talks with Bill. And I think there's always importance of having, you know, Ben Crenshaw probably got them a lot of jobs and opportunities early that they wouldn't have gotten because of who he was. And I think that's something that can't be, you know, downplayed is in the architecture sense. Like a lot of people will probably dismiss a little bit of Ben's because Bill's obviously very heavily involved with all their projects, but I think that they underrate the influence that Ben has and the amount of, you know, cachet that Ben brings to the table for that partnership.
Yeah. All right. So legacy, architecture, amateur career, greatest putter of all time. Maybe a lot of people say that. I have an amazing Justin Leonard quote from an Alan Shipnuck article this year on celebrating the 25th anniversary of his 95 Masters win. This is just fantastic on Leonard. You can't copy his stroke and you wouldn't want to. He has a different technique on different putts. He'll draw putts, slice putts, hit the ball on the toe to deaden the speed. For him, it's all about feel. He has the best speed control I've ever seen, and that's all he cared about. Not the way it looked. It's fascinating to spend time with him because his approach is so different from everybody else who's all trying to, they're all trying to groove the same stroke over and over. Pretty cool.
Yeah, really
cool. For someone who's like the greatest putter ever, but it's like sui generis. Like it's not necessarily something you'd want to mimic.
It's natural.
Or possible to mimic, maybe. Yeah, all feel. He's architecture.
An authentic player.
Greatest putter ever, maybe. You know, that's a subjective title. Architecture, legacy. Legacy as a player. I mean, he talks about now, he's like, I couldn't believe some of the things that were written about me. You know, the next Nicklaus. Palmer's charisma, Nicklaus's game, Jones's, you know, sense of history.
It's a tricky one from the legacy standpoint. Because from a professional golf standpoint, I think like, I don't know if he gets in from just professional golf for me.
Really?
I think like...
The close calls have an impact on me.
The close calls
do. He's so close to being foul, though. He's so close to having six. But I mean, you know, there's doing it and then there's not having it, I guess.
But what puts me over the edge, like, I mean, like, there just was a lot of mediocre, and a lot of it's because of the disease, you know, there's stuff, but I would put it over the edge with the amateur, you know,
yeah,
without a doubt, one of the five best amateur players ever.
Yeah.
And then from an architecture standpoint, like, overall impact on the game, huge.
Steward of the game.
Yeah.
Like, he's just a voice with the history. Like, he's now, he's the ringleader. He's the leader of the Tuesday night Champions Dinner. Like, that's been given to him because of his history. Like, he leads the dinner. I don't know. They talk about that a lot. Whether it's this Hall of Fame speech or he's just known as, like, a guy that people defer to on what's good for the game, what's right for the game. They talked about a little bit about the Masters, you know, Augusta changing the course, and he was too gracious to really talk about it too much when they Tiger proofed it and all that. But yeah, he's just like as a voice in the game, and a lot of that's derived from his massive success early on, right? You don't just get that kind of authority to speak like that unless you were also maybe one of the greatest amateur players ever, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So it kind of all goes hand in hand. There's this package with him. So do you think you may not put him in on pro golf alone?
He's right on right on the border, because, you know, he won two Masters, which is, you know, he's in that same guy. But I mean, all the close calls too.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. Is he's in the low rung, the bottom rung.
Interesting. Okay. All right, Ben Crenshaw. Solid 2 hours on Ben. But, you know, we did 2 hours on Lyle, too, right? So we can do two hours on anybody.
2 hours on Davis Love.
There we go. All right. Thank you all. We'll be back Monday with a regular course of business podcast. Thanks, guys.